The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Today we got my good friend Sagi Shaked here, and we are at the new Hermosa Beach TLU Trial Dojo. And it was great because Sagi came in last night and we had a little happy hour, a few friends over.
We did.
And then because we were thinking ahead, we got the dojo, we got extra rooms besides for me. So Sagi was able to. How was your first night at the trial dojo, Sagi?
It was awesome. We had a great time with a bunch of friends, get together, and then we had drinks, obviously, and then get to talk about cases. And
down at the Strand, it was only about a 100-yard walk, although it was a little windy last night because we had an unseasonable storm here. It caused for a little leak up there in the corner, but we're going to get that addressed. But it's a good thing it started early so we can address the problems of the dojo early, knock all the kinks out, get all the wiring done, and boom, then we're going to be ready to really work on some of Sagi's big cases here.
But the connections were there. We made connections, and that's what it's all about.
Yes. And so, Sagi, speaking of trials, you've had a couple trials recently. So that's what I want to talk to you about those. I'm going to talk to you about what you'll be teaching at TLU Beach this year. And also a couple, I know the thing you're most excited about, though, are you got your two children. Your son, who's going to start, he's graduating from UCLA this year, is that right?
Correct, yeah.
And going to Georgetown next year?
Georgetown Law.
And your daughter is where?
At Georgetown Law.
Look at that. They got to stay. What a close family. Mm-hmm. Both, and they both went to school in California?
Correct, yeah.
See, they got good taste because California is quite superior to Florida. Much more free thinking out here. A little less all that red MAGA correct. A little
that's
less.
What you ask, yeah.
I mean, you're in Huntington Beach, you might get a little more of the, you know, I got people that don't want to come to Huntington Beach, like it's too MAGA. I'm like, I can't help what the people believe in the neighborhood. It's a nice hotel, it's our hotel. So if you don't want to come, I can't help it, but I think you should put aside. I understand where they're coming from, but that's going too far, not coming to Huntington Beach. But anyways, so I know that's part of a lot of your motivation for you with your kids becoming lawyers.
Yeah, absolutely. I really can't wait for them to come in and practice, and they're both excited about it. So it's going to be fun.
So Sagi, you've had two trials in the last few months. So I want to discuss those with you. So the trial you had back in December, give us the backstory of that trial.
So it was an auto collision, client's a passenger. It was issues with drugs. He sustained a jaw fracture. Complained of neck and back, and then had a component of a TBI in it as well. Not in the trial, but those were the initial or complaints throughout.
And so, to give a little context, what was the highest offer from the insurance company?
So when I got involved, the highest offer was $200,000.
Okay, how far before trial did you get involved?
About 4 months before the trial.
And so when you get involved in a case that you did not work up, what is your process to get that case ready for trial?
So as soon as I get the case, I want to make sure we meet all the deadlines because in Florida, the judges have really hampered down on or, you know, gotten strict on these deadlines. So make sure we meet all the deadlines with witnesses, get all our exhibits in order really in advance because you have to exchange very early on. You can't do it the week before. And then study the case. Is there something bad about the case that's going to hurt us when we get to trial? Or is there something that's going to hurt credibility? So I'm always looking at credibility in every case, because without credibility, I mean, you lose your case. So that's kind of what I'm looking at.
Okay. And so you said the highest offer before you got involved was $200,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And where was your demand at?
So we were at $1 million. We wanted the policy limits and they weren't budging. They weren't going to pay that. They said this is their best offer. And they never really went off that. They wanted us off the million. We wouldn't come off the million. So this is a case that happened in Tampa, Florida.
TLU Huntington Beach is going to be the greatest event of 2026. There's going to be 4 lecture tracks, 8 workshop tracks with the top trial lawyers in the country. On Tuesday, June 2nd, there's going to be a golf outing and also a pickleball outing. that night, we're going to have a dinner at the La Rea. We're going to buy it out so everybody gets a chance to meet each other beforehand. And then during the conference, of course, we do a full breakfast, full lunch, and theme parties every night. This year, we're going to be utilizing the pool area and the restaurant for more of the parties. And we're going to have an adult swim one night, a Satch Oliver party on Friday night. And the last theme party is going to be a 80s Run DMC Adidas jumpsuit. It's going to be the greatest. And last year, we had over 800 people. This year, it's going to be over 1,000. So if you want to be part of it all and you want to stay at the Paseo Hotel, don't delay because it sells out fast and then you're going to be in the overflow. Can't wait to see you there. TLU Beach.
Okay. And you say it was an auto case. So what was the, I mean, what was the context of the case?
So client
collision.
It was a T-bone collision. The defendant made a left turn right in front of our client who was a passenger in the car. This was around 2 a.m. in the morning. And I'll tell you other things. The client, like I said, the client had some drugs in his system at the time.
What kind of drugs?
So cocaine, meth, and also a little alcohol. Never hurts.
You know what? It's a good combination. They call it the party cocktail. A little cocaine, a little meth. Who doesn't a little cocaine, meth, and alcohol in their system just from walking around? I mean, how do you function without a little pick-me-up here and there, combined with a little depressant to just mess with your system a little bit?
So we did file a motion in limine on that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we were in the trial, the defense claimed we opened the door.
How did they claim you opened the door?
So the plaintiff was on the stand at that point. It was day two in the trial. The plaintiff was on the stand, and it was through an interpreter. Even though he understood English, he still wanted the interpreter. And he said after the collision, he felt dizzy, he felt confused. And so defense got up and said that the door was opened because we all know that anyone who uses cocaine or meth is going to feel dizzy and confused. Now, I don't know that, right? Do you know that?
I thought cocaine really helps you focus. Now, meth and alcohol, meth, I can't comment, but I've seen people use cocaine before. That's the extent of my knowledge, and they seem pretty focused.
More focused, right?
More focused. They got a lot of energy. They're just jumping. They got so much energy.
So the defense in the case, they were trying to tell the judge, this evidence should come in because we all know, everybody knows, that when you use cocaine, you get dazed and confused. And I'm like, judge, I don't know. I think if they wanted to bring that evidence in, they should have gotten an expert to talk about the effects of cocaine on the brain and how it impacts the person's perception, reaction. Does it cause dizziness? Does it cause confusion? So the judge thought about it and gave us 20 minutes to come up with some research, and then ultimately he excluded that. We didn't open the door, thankfully.
Yeah, it seems like it'd be a...
Who wants to give money to a guy high on coke and doing meth and alcohol?
You know what? That's a good point. So we got a little context to the case, and now you're getting ready for trial. So in this case, when you get to the court, what is your focus in voir dire for this particular case?
Yeah, so because my client was a passenger in this case, in this collision case, I really didn't think that they were going to dispute liability. Initially, they did, and then the morning of, they think they're going to trick us, right? We're going to admit liability. So we prepare. Before we get to voir dire, I'm always preparing two types of voir dire, two types of opening. One, if they take the route that they're disputing liability. And the other route, if they're not disputing liability. So in this case, right before we started voir dire, they admitted liability, which I thought the right thing to do. And so the focus of the trial changed. It wasn't, hey, I got to prove liability and damages or causation and damages. It's damages. So everything in voir dire was dealing with damages, money and damages. I wanted to make sure the jury in Tampa would be able to compensate us for that.
Because the jury in Tampa, just to give people context, is a little less generous than juries in perhaps Miami, where you're from.
That's about accurate.
That's about accurate. And so the top concept of money, give us some ideas of the questions you asked the jury. Because I know we got a little pushback from at least some of the jurors.
So one of the questions I like to ask in every trial, and it's a fair question to ask, how many people, as you sit here today, have any trouble, even a little trouble, compensating someone for their injuries? And we had just a basic question, not even talking about millions or anything like that, just compensating someone for their injuries. And we had a young lady who was a teacher, elementary school teacher, and she raised her hand and she's like, I can't do it. I'm not going to compensate anyone for injuries. I make $50,000, $60,000 a year. I don't remember the number she said. And I work hard for my money. Why should they get compensated for their injuries? And then you start seeing other people agreeing, they're nodding. And so you start following up with everybody on those questions. Because if they don't want to compensate, forget about millions or even asking for that kind of money. If they can't compensate just for the, you know, a person's injuries, that's a problem.
Yes. And so, you know, a lot of people, when they get those kind of answers, they like get like, oh my God, I can't, this is such a bad answer. But we know from, you know, as we get more experience, that that's actually a great answer. And it's a great thing to have, because now we can take that, you know, because like when I help teach people voir dire, I always tell people, you know, when they get an answer like that or any kind of resistance, you have to meet people where they're at before you can take them where you want them to go. So somebody says something like that, you know, the best thing to say is, you know what? Something along the lines of, you know, that's a great point you bring up. And I bet you're not alone. I bet there's probably a lot of other people here that maybe feel a little bit like you do. Who here feels maybe even just a little bit like juror X? And so now kind of encourages that kind of free, you know, brutal honesty. And then you find the other people that you need to identify quickly to get off the jury. Because I mean, somebody believes like that, there's not a whole lot of, quote, unquote, I obviously want to rehabilitate somebody. They're beyond rehabilitation if they have that kind of mindset. And so that kind of basic one, did you get some, how many people, when she raised her hand, how many other people did you get off for cause?
I remember, so she said that she would, you know, we would start off with a strike against us. And that's like the key in Florida. Based on that statement that she wouldn't want to compensate somebody who was injured, we'd start off with a strike against us. And then you start asking who else here feels like, let's call her Miss Jones. Miss Jones, raise your hand. Or how many of you feel like Miss Jones? And then I tell them it's okay to feel like Miss Jones. My parents are on, you know, completely opposite when it comes to injury cases. My father doesn't like them. He just doesn't believe you should get compensated like you, Miss Jones. How many people are like Miss Jones and my father? Raise your hand. And then they start raising their hands. And we had about four or five people that we got off. And there was a group of about 30 plus people there. So to remember 30 plus names, thankfully I have the chart, you know, because it's hard. So I was able to help, you know, get some people off there.
I bet. And so after we get through jury selection, let's talk about, obviously we got openings, but let's talk about the sequencing of witnesses. When, you know, an admitted liability, so as opposed to contested liability. So talk about how you think about your sequencing of witnesses and what you put up here.
So every case that I have starts off with damages. It starts with damages every day. It ends with damages every day. We're injury lawyers. So I usually like to see fire rescue as the first witness, just to start the case. Because usually it's a witness that can't be impeached. They really don't have a stake in the game. And, you know, they come in and deliver the testimony. What's the defense going to do? The guy's jaw was fractured at the scene. You know? Yeah, he didn't complain. So in this specific case, when we started the trial, we had dropped the claims for the neck, the back, and the brain, and only went on the jaw fracture for this specific trial.
So it was a jaw fracture case.
Right, because the other issues, the neck, the back, and the brain, they didn't come about till almost 7-8 months. The brain didn't come about till almost 2 years later. It's really hard to relate those injuries to the crash when you're talking about that much time goes by. And that was what the defense was going to harp on. Why did they wait so long? In fact, when we started the trial before the openings, you saw them come in with these huge boards. I'm talking about boards the size of a huge monster TV, but like six of them, where they were going to put them up all on easels. So imagine one, covering the entire courtroom to talk about how big the gaps in treatment were before you saw the first complaint. So when we dropped those other claims, it kind of diffused their entire case. We cut their entire case.
Join us April 15th and 16th in Hermosa Beach, California at the TLU Beach House. We are doing a 2-day witness prep and direct examination workshop. The witness prep will teach you not only how to get your clients to remember their stories, but to relive them. And then the direct examination, so the jury just doesn't hear the story, but they experience it, they witness it. And this is right before Nick Reilly's trial by human in West Hollywood, April 17th through 19th. So come for the witness prep, stay for trial by human. We'll see you there.
So when they thought they were being tricky by admitting liability on the day of, they had no idea how tricky could be when you got three out of four claims and they got all this stuff to attack with, and now something's almost unimpeachable because the guy broke some of his teeth, didn't he?
Exactly. He broke his jaw.
Yeah. And so they had a tough time. I mean, they didn't just say it was a coincidence that his jaw broke on this day.
No, they didn't go with that. But for the crash,
his jaw would have broke anyways because he had a pre-existing weak jaw.
Next time
he ate anything that was crunchy like cereal, his jaw was dead. They didn't tell you, oh, I'm surprised. No, they didn't have something like that.
They didn't go with that. And what happened was, we really, when we cut out those other claims, we cut out their experts. You cut out their radiologist. You cut out their orthopedic. You cut out everything. And what do? The case falls apart. And they were... called dumbfounded, I guess you can use. When we did that, he didn't know what to do. No one's ever done that to him last minute. So it was a unique surprise for him, not for me, but.
I'm used to surprising people. I like to make trial more fun and interesting and lots of surprises, not just predictable.
Well, the defense always does it. They'll admit liability and say they're good people. We're doing the right thing here.
I don't suggest you shouldn't surprise them. I mean, that's part of the strategy of trial, right?
Absolutely.
That's what makes it fun and entertaining. Every day is different. Every day is a different strategy.
And there's always something crazy that goes on in a trial. Like I told you, when we opened the door, or they claimed we opened the door, there's always something. And in fact, in this case, I'll tell you about the jury. Remember the story we talked about?
Yeah.
So we're about to close on this case, and it's 4:00 on a Tuesday. And the judge asks the jury, do you want them to close now and stay through as late as you need to get this case done, or do you want to come back the next morning? So jury, they take a vote, and they want to come back the next morning. Of course, I wanted to close on Tuesday, because if we closed on Tuesday, I was ready. And this defense lawyer was still trying to catch up with what happened on Monday. So judge lets the jury go down. So jury goes downstairs, my client heads downstairs, the defendant heads downstairs, and we're packing. We're getting our stuff ready to go back to the hotel room to continue to prepare for closing. While we're packing, I get a text message. And my co-counsel, Brian, also gets a text message. And it's a picture. And I really don't know what this picture is. I'm like, I see two people. And then it's a video. And I'm looking at it. I still don't understand it. So I call the client. He's like, do you see what I just sent you? I go, yeah, but what is it? He goes, the defendant is walking with one of the jurors. I'm like, oh, this is interesting, because we all know you're not supposed to talk to the jury, right? That's common sense. And so they're walking for about 3 blocks into the parking lot. So I really don't know what to do. So next morning, we bring it up in front of the judge. We're like, judge, we have an issue here. Our juror was talking to one of the defendants. And so the judge brings in each juror individually and ask them questions. Finally, he gets to the juror that was talking to the defendant, and the juror admits, yes, we were talking. We were only talking about the weather in Tampa, how it was really cold, and this was in December, and that there was a homeless problem in Tampa in the downtown area. So being that, the judge didn't think anything of it. I was kind of concerned that they developed some sort of bond. Maybe they weren't telling us everything that was talked about. So we moved to get her taken off the jury and have the alternate replace her. The judge asked defense counsel if he has any objection, and defense counsel said, I really can't object because they spoke. So that juror is removed and the alternate takes her place. And then the judge told us this, because closings are coming up, I don't want the jury to think anything. We're gonna let that juror sit, listen to closings, but she doesn't get to go back into the jury deliberation. Fast forward, we do closing arguments, and the jury gets the case. They're now deliberating. And so what happens? The judge tells that alternate juror now, the one that was supposed to be on the jury, you can go home. And she's like, she raises her hand. Judge, can I stay? He goes, you can do whatever you want. She wanted to stay to see what the verdict was. So, okay. So now I'm like, we can talk to her. So we go and talk to her, because in Florida, if they don't want to talk to you, they don't have to. But she said she wanted to talk to us. So we start talking to her. And then she tells us, you know, I liked your case. I'm like, okay. And I would have given you $3 million.
Not a dollar more than $3 million. Yeah, not a $4 to $6 million.
Right, yeah. Not a dollar more than $3 million. I'm like, I don't know. I think I got rid of my best juror. So fast forward now, the jury comes back with their verdict, you know, and it's $800,000. So, you know, in hindsight, maybe, now knowing what I know now from that specific case, right, I wish I didn't take her off. But, you know, I think every time I replay that situation in my mind, because, you know, you can always replay it and replay it and think, I wish I would have kept her, but I think I did the right thing there.
Come on, you can't leave that juror on there, because you just don't know. It's too big a variable. And I mean, unless that alternate is horrible for you, it seems like a no-brainer. So
yeah, I thought she was good, but I was concerned about maybe they developed some sort of bond in the three blocks that they walked. So it was a little concerning.
So you 4X the offer, so that's a pretty good result.
Yeah.
But then the next trial you got, you did a little better than 4X, because
we did a little bit better.
Little bit better than 4X. And this, what was this case about?
So this trial is a premises case where a gate, it's a 24 foot length, 8 feet high gate, weighs about 1,000 pounds, falls on our client. And so we sued the landowner and sued the tenant. We resolved it with the tenant, and now the case was just against the landowner. And so she had a TBI. The landowner didn't want to offer any money until the start of trial. They offered us $50,000.
On the start of trial?
Right on, yeah, about a day before the trial, they'll say we'll pay $50,000.
Was he insured?
Huh?
Was he insured?
He has property, so the insurance, yeah, there was insurance, but not for that amount what we wanted. So he has property worth over $5 million.
All right.
So, and it's a problem for him. So we start the trial, they only offer $50,000. And my client...
What was your demand?
$350,000. Because we had settled out with the other entity, so we were ready to get this case resolved. And we just couldn't get there.
So they wouldn't get up to $350,000?
They would not.
April 21st through 25th in Hermosa Beach, California, we're hosting a boot camp where you will train in the fundamental skills of trial. Witness prep and direct, cross-examination, performance skills, which are opening statement and closing argument, and jury selection, or voir dire, depending on where you live. We're going to focus on eye contact, voice control, emotional state control, hand and body movement, glance control, creating space, amongst other skills. And then once you learn these skills, we're going to apply them to your case. So at the end of the day, it's an investment and a case expense. This program will fundamentally change your life.
And so the gate falls on the lady, but what were the big challenges? There were some big challenges in this case.
So the defense took the position that when that gate fell on her, there was no eyewitnesses other than her husband. And you can't believe her husband because he has an interest in the case. The defense claimed that she fell in the property, not that a gate fell on her. And one of the challenges that we had was there was four witnesses, according to fire rescue. When the fire rescue got there, the gate had been lifted already and put back in its place. So the defense said, how could a 1,000-pound gate be lifted and put exactly back in its place? That was one of their issues.
Fair question.
Another issue is the four witnesses, nobody knew who they were. And this was a industrial kind of a complex. And the defendant himself said, I went to everybody. I know I worked there for the last 30 years. I know every single owner there. I went to everybody and asked if anybody saw this happen. And nobody saw it happen. The defense claimed the gate had been put in 17 years ago and never fallen. Nobody ever had an issue with it. So when we tried to get in the statement of fire rescue, because in his report, the fire rescue said four people told him that a gate had fallen on someone. And so we had him come and testify, And then the defense wanted to voir dire him on the issue of, you know,
we presence want that, sense impression, yeah, excited utterance. Is there some, exactly. Is there an exception to the hearsay rule?
Exactly.
That would allow these statements to come in.
So what the fire rescue testified to was, you know, I've been doing this for many years, and tell me an auto accident, I probably wouldn't remember. But when there's a gate that falls on someone and the issues surrounding that happened then, that's an incident I do remember. Okay, so what do you remember? He said, it was frantic. People were in shock. And they were telling me that the gate fell on her. So what do you think I'm thinking when I hear frantic and shock?
Excited utterance.
Excited utterance.
All right.
It comes right in.
Evidence, and, we know it.
Yeah, so it's like one of those exceptions, right? And I'm like, ooh, frantic and shock. And clearly, the fire rescue, you can tell he was a little upset with the way the defense lawyer was questioning him. The defense lawyer was trying to say, hey, as if you're not telling us the truth. It's in his report. Before any lawyer got involved, before anyone got the case, he said in his report, four strangers, or four bystanders, he called them, told them the gate fell on him. And so we got that statement in, and that was important for the case,
you
obviously.
Think?
Because then it's just the husband saying it.
Now it's not just the husband saying it.
We
got four
other
people verifying, even though they know who these people are.
Right. So that was one hurdle in the case. Another hurdle in the case is the client hadn't gone to treatment for a very long time. And that's
what's
always
a very long time? A year, two
a year,
years?
A year. And that's a problem. And then there was gaps between that treatment. So anytime you don't have someone going or managing the case, going to treatment, it's a problem because the defense is going to harp on that. And they did, you know, obviously.
Can't blame them. They're trying not to pay money. Right. You're trying to take their money. You got this tension, mm-hmm. with this money tension. All right.
And then another issue is the last thing the client remembers, because she claims she passed out. But the last thing the client remembers is being in the property and going down some stairs. And that's the last thing she remembers. So the defense, they make their whole case about, this is not a gate that fell on this woman. Remember what she told you. She fell, she remembers going down the steps and nothing else. And that's kind of how they argued it in closing.
That she fell down the stairs. And the rest
she fell down the stairs because that's the last thing she remembers. And so that, you know, they pulled up a picture from the gate and you see these stairs over here, that's where she fell. And I kind of prepared for that because I thought it was the most outrageous argument to make. Why would some, because he's calling her basically a liar. He's calling the husband a liar. He's calling fire rescue a liar. And the four bystanders, they're liars too.
It's a big conspiracy.
And then the person that called 911, that person's also a liar. So everyone's-
Who called 911?
Some stranger, we don't know who it is.
Did they say a gate had fell?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, but that statement didn't come in, but-
Why did it not come in? As an excited utterance or present sense impression?
We don't know who it was and we don't know what they said. The judge wouldn't allow it in.
We know we don't, you know, there's nothing that says you have to identify an excited utterance. Where's that in the rules?
We couldn't get it in, but we got the fact that someone called 911 and it wasn't the husband.
Got it.
And so when I got back up, you know, after they did their closing, I got back up in rebuttal and I'm like, did I just hear right? He's saying that this 1,000-pound gate didn't fall on her. That didn't cause her to fracture her nose or the orbital fracture. That's not what caused it. And then you see me running in the courtroom. This is where she fell, where the stairs are. And then the husband, he picks her up and he runs over to the gate, puts her right near the gate. Somehow the husband manages to take this 1,000-pound gate, put it down on his wife. Nobody else sees it, right? And then he manages to get four bystanders in cahoots with the person who called 911. And then he also manages to get fire rescue to do the same. Now at the same time, I'm looking at the jury and some of them have these big smirks on them. I don't know if they're smiling at me because it makes sense what I'm saying, or they're smiling at me because I'm being ridiculous with my argument. Obviously later we found out that they were on my side. So what I argued was, everyone's in on this conspiracy. Fire rescue, the bystanders, the person who called 911, the husband, everybody's in on it, except the person who wanted to take responsibility. And obviously the jury came back in our favor.
Yes, well, Let's back up a little bit, because this was a contested liability.
Correct.
So how, you know, the last case we talked about was admitted liability. So how is your approach to voir dire, I assume, is a little bit different now?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to hit the issues. So in this case specifically, one of the issues was that gate was not built up to code. So there's something called the South Florida Building Code, and you have to comply with the code. And if you don't build it up to the code, it's a violation, right? And it can cause people, dangerous things can happen. And the code is what you call the minimum standards. So one of the things I wanted to get out in voir dire, that the law is on our side. How many people think that you should follow the law? Following the law is very important, right? So I want everyone to agree that the law is important, following the law is important, and they're all gonna do that, whether it's the jury instructions, whether it's the plaintiff or defendant. Nobody is above the law. Can we all agree with that? And they all agreed with that. So that was one thing that I wanted to know. And then this was an incident where, you know, we're claiming the gate fell on someone and they got hurt. So anybody have a problem with people who get hurt and bring claims? Some people had a problem, like in every panel across the country, there's always gonna be someone who says, can't compensate for that. But my thing was, this is the law. If you follow the law, then, you know, we're gonna win. So that's kind of what I wanted to get on liability there.
Okay, and then as far as the sequencing of, and I assume you do all the same, you know, similar type of damages, voir dire, obviously.
Sure.
And then how about the sequencing of witnesses, not a contested liability?
So case is always about damages, whether it's contested or not. But going back to voir dire, in this case, I thought it was a case that we can get millions of dollars on. And so I wanted to ask the jury about cases that juries have awarded millions of dollars on. So how many people here have heard about other cases in Florida where juries have awarded millions, tens of millions of dollars? Raise your hand. How many people have any problems with juries awarded tens of millions of dollars? So we did that a little different than the Tampa case. And then going to the sequencing, again, I'm a personal injury lawyer. It's about damages. Every case is damages. So again, how did this case start? Probably like most of my cases, fire rescue coming. Talk about what they saw.
Talk about the four excited utterance bystanders.
Absolutely, but also talk about the damages. Right. It's a damages case. So that's really what you want to do. If you're, for me, again, it works for me. I'm sure everybody has their own way of doing things, but I like damages.
I like damages because it's about money.
Yeah.
And you like money too.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And so this case, their maximum offer is $50,000. What was your ask of the jury? What did you tell the jury it was worth?
$6 million.
$6 million. And at the end of the day, what did the jury tell you it was worth?
$4.5 million.
Okay, so they were a lot closer to you. So if you do that 50 times 20, 20 times 4.5. So basically you did 90x your offer. That's a little more. The last case we talked about, the 4x your offer, I'm like,
this was a little better.
A little disappointing. I'm like, I don't know if you deserve a stage at TLU if you can only 4x an offer. But
that's true.
Now that you can 90x an offer,
Now I want the red carpet. Now I want the red carpet.
I don't know about that, but at least you have the chops. We're going to make sure you got the chops before you come to TLU. Because I think at TLU Beach, have you been to every year the last 4 years?
I have.
All right. So you've seen
the evolution.
The evolution.
How it's grown, and it gets better. It really is the best conference out there. If someone wants to learn, and connect with some of the best trial lawyers in the country and just share ideas and share thoughts and become friends with people who we talk about the same things. You know, sometimes people get tired about me talking about cases if they're not in that world.
Right.
And they're like, oh, that's all you talk about. I'm like, that's who I am. So it's kind of hard to not talk about that.
People are like, are you always on? I'm like, you're always on. I'm like, what does that mean? Like, yeah, because like all my friends are lawyers or are generally in the industry. Somebody that, you know, is an engineer for a living. I'm sorry. I'm not going to have enough in common with them to even have a conversation to give a rat's ass. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be so superficial, but if you're not in the law business.
Well, you see it. Someone who's in the law and you start talking about your case, their eyes light up.
Right.
And your eyes, like, I'm like, wow, they're interested too. I'm like, okay.
Okay, now we talk.
Now you're having conversations and you're getting ideas and it just gets better and better and better. So that's what TLU does. It gives people, again, that chance to really connect with like-minded people who really want to help others, people who've been victims for no reason at all. And so it's a great way to help your clients by coming to Huntington. I always learn when I go, whether I'm teaching I'm always learning from others too.
Sagi is without a doubt, the world's greatest student. So long as I've known Sagi, which has been, I think we first connected in Baltimore probably 11 or 12 years ago. I don't really remember, through Connell. But every day of the AAJ, we're on our way down this afternoon. Every day you'll see Sagi there with his suit on, you know, and with his laptop out in class. The rest of us are out hanging out, having coffee, seeing the scenes. Not Sagi, we're Sagi. Sagi's in class. I've always been impressed with that, especially, you know, some of the very mediocre presentations that you sat through. I know you, I know your mindset is like, I get my work done while I'm here, do some emails. If I hear something that, you know, they're likely to have one nugget there. That's in the hour presentation, they're gonna have one thing that you say, okay, I can apply that to one of my cases. So the consummate student of the game, which is helpful though, because you gotta stay curious in this game.
Sure, I mean, if you're not getting better, you're getting what? Worse, right? So I'm always trying to get better, trying to improve, trying to, you know, learn from other people.
Join me and my mentor, David Clark, May 27th through June 2nd in Huntington Beach, California, for a dark arts boot camp. This program will change your life. Dave will teach you about neurolinguistic programming, conversational hypnosis, embedding stories in the unconscious mind. He changed my life, and he'll change yours. And I'll coach you on your witness prep and direct, cross-examination, performance skills for opening statement and closing argument, and voir dire. These days will change your life. Come for the boot camp, stay for TLU Beach, the greatest conference ever.
And I know, because you told me, but like in this last trial, because some of this to train that we've done on connection, and even though you haven't, you know, you've only done a little bit, you haven't done the full boot camp yet, but even the time that we spent a little bit, how did you apply some of the skills that you learned in this last trial?
So what you taught me is completely different than what they teach you, you know, in law school. Go back to law school and they tell you when you're doing your presentation, so you don't get nervous, don't look people in the eye, look between the two people. And I'm like, that's a horrible way. Now, knowing what I know now, right? I've been doing this now, this is 2026, so 26 years. What a mistake that was, right? Because you have professors who, nothing against professors, right? But they're really not trial lawyers unless they're teaching trial advocacy. And this is
They're like judges or prosecutors, people that never really had the difficulty of trying the case is like a plaintiff's lawyer or a criminal offense lawyer. Those are tough cases. Being a prosecutor is a joke. Being a judge, all due respect, is a very easy job. You get to sit there and do whatever the hell you want, and everybody laughs at your jokes, even if they're not funny.
Right.
You know, and it's like, it's a government, you know, steady paycheck type of job. You usually don't find the most brilliant, ambitious people wanting to sit on, you know, could you imagine going from where you're at to being a judge? Like, forget about the fuck.
Look, being a judge is a very important job. I don't want to be a judge,
I mean, for like somebody like the way we're wired though.
Right.
Forget about the money. Let's say the money was the same, but to sit there every day and just call balls and strikes instead of being the guy at the plate with the bases loaded.
Right.
Like, it would be horrible. Horrible.
But going back to your connection, so what I learned in law school was completely wrong. The way you connect with someone and how you're teaching it and to connect with getting, you know, making that eye contact, and not just eye contact, but really connecting with that eye contact with that juror or the next juror or the next juror, and keep going, it makes a difference. And I think it made a difference, and especially in the last case, where they can feel that, you know, I'm on their side, we're together. This is us against them, right? We're going against the defense. They're the big bad bullies, and we're here representing the righteous person, the injured person. So we do make a connection, and teaching that connection, I know it's easy, it sounds easy, oh, just look the person in the eye. It's not easy by any means. It's practice and repetition. It's really difficult.
Practice and repetition. All right, speaking of practice and repetition, this year you'll be teaching your TBI masterclass, and you taught it last year. And so I know you've made some changes this year. So that's a one-day class you're gonna teach on Friday, June 5th, all day long. And so what will people who decide to sign up for your class, what will they be getting from you?
So if you haven't tried a TBI case, or you're looking to try a TBI case,
or you're looking to get better at trying TBI cases,
right, or even just identifying them and working them up, because I guarantee you everybody has them, but they're probably undersettling them. So what I'm going to do during the class is first, how to identify a TBI, because it's not just an orthopedic case, there's also a TBI component to it. So one, identifying it. Two,
and so speaking of identifying it, though, what are some of the big myths or things that people think they need to have to identify it and maybe overlook?
So the number one myth, and we heard it, you know, in this last trial, is you have to lose consciousness. It's not true. And so that's like the biggest myth. You'll hear every adjuster tell you, they didn't lose consciousness, they can't be brain injured. That's not true. The literature is out there, you don't have to lose consciousness. If a person's dizzy or confused at the scene, that's a sign of a brain injury. So don't just let the insurance company, whether it's the attorney, what they teach at the Defense Research Institute, or the adjuster, don't let them persuade you that your client doesn't have an injury. And usually on these TBIs, I'm talking about the mild traumatic brain injuries, not where someone's head has been cracked open or you have fractures in the head. I'm talking about no fractures, you're trying this case or you have this case, you're gonna get a lowball offer. So you gotta get prepared to work the case right from a medical standpoint, and then you gotta get prepared to prepare your client for deposition, prepare them for that DME or CME, whatever you want to call it, and then for trial. Otherwise, you're going to get low offers. You're not going to get the full value of those cases.
Right. So first you said, so part of your class, first identifying it, and then beyond identifying it, give us the other steps that you're going to walk people through.
Identifying it, understanding the medicine, so now you can medically manage the case, right? Identifying what doctors can help your client medically, because you don't want to just send, it's not just a case, you got to also help the client get the right treatment, right? Are these doctors able to help your client get better? It's not just about a case, right? Yes, we want to get the money, and the money's great, but you want your clients to get better, because we're not just in it for the money. And then once you've done that, now you're going to have depositions. A lot of times clients can't remember what happened. Don't make them remember what happened. If they don't remember, that's a fact. They lost consciousness, or they didn't, but they may not remember. They have amnesia of how the crash occurred. That's fine. So preparing for that deposition, preparing for that CME, and then getting them ready for trial. And what exhibits you need to use, how you talk to the doctors, maybe a direct for a doctor, and we're going to do some sequencing for some jury selection questions.
And so when you get, I know a lot of the cases that you work on, a lot of cases you try are brought to you by other lawyers. Typically, like you said, a few months, 4 months, 5 months before a trial. So, you know, of course, people get their case, try to work it up, settle it so they can keep the money for themselves, right? They don't have to bring in. I mean, that's natural. People want to make the most money they can for themselves. Get it. But when it gets to that point, so what are some of the mistakes you've seen with people in their medical management before they bring you the case?
So we'll talk about one, gaps in treatment. The defense loves gaps in treatment. If your client is hurt and you're going to trial on an injury case, the jury wants to see people that are still going to treatment. Because if they're not going to treatment, they're back to normal. So that's one mistake that I see in cases.
That people are not properly medically managing their clients.
Right.
Is really what it is.
Yeah. I think that's a huge problem. And there's many others. If you come to the class, we're going to talk about them and how to address them.
And you said getting your client ready for deposition. So again, what are some of the big mistakes you see?
One of the mistakes, first of all, in a traumatic brain injury case, a lot of times, especially if they have like a frontal lobe injury where it's impacting their emotional state, very difficult to prepare with a TBI victim for a deposition. So I see a lot of lawyers preparing the day before or sometimes the morning of the deposition. What a horrible mistake. Don't do that. If you have a TBI case, you need to put in 5 sessions. I know it's work. And I would start about a month to a month and a half before, start working with them, and you're going to get frustrated because they make mistakes. They don't remember much. So you have to drill with them, do the deposition, and then have someone play the defendant asking them questions, and we're going to go through that, what I like to do during the deposition. So that's another, you know, area we're going to address.
Yep, and you know, for people that want more help on their witness prepping, March 6th and 7th, we're doing a witness prep and direct workshop right here at the dojo. Still got a 2 spots available. It's limited to 10 people because we got to get lots of individualized attention on it. In addition to doing this lecture or this masterclass, you're going to do 2 hours of lecture on Thursday.
Yes.
And so what are we covering on those?
So on Thursday, we're going to address the major mistakes or defenses that the defense brings in auto accident cases, right? I hate the word accident, but people are using it. So auto crash, auto collision, the major defenses that we see and how to defuse them. So we're going to identify them and then talk about them, how to defuse each specific one. So if you start at the beginning and you address these and you educate your client, because it's all about education, then you won't have these defenses. And some of them are self-inflicted. We talked about earlier gaps, right? Gaps in treatment can be cured if you educate the client at the beginning of the case. So,
right, the necessity of continuing to go on. And so you're going to do 2 hours on, because there's a lot of mistakes people make that are costing themselves a lot of money.
So. Right. I mean, you're costing your clients a lot of money, and in return, you're costing yourself. So if you address these and you can put in systems in place so that it doesn't happen. Now, you know, I don't know if you can address it if you're handling thousands of cases, but if you're handling, you know, a fair number of cases, you can address this, and you give the clients that one-on-one time, you can really address this and change the value of the case.
Besides going to, you know, the conferences like the AJ we're going to today or TLU, I know you're a big continuing learner because, you know, I keep the stats on who watches TLU on demand, and always at, every month you're always at the top of the list. So tell us, you know, how you've utilized TLU on demand to, I guess, help, you know, get to where you're at. You know, how do you utilize it to improve your skills?
So one, I wish TLU on demand was available when I was a young lawyer. It wasn't. You'd have to go to conferences. So now, having that on demand, and for me, you know, I go running or I'll exercise. While I'm doing that, I'm listening to whether it's a podcast that TLU had or someone else's lecture, because I'm always able to get something out of it. So I'm trying to always get better, right? And if you're listening to that, you're getting better, and then taking notes and then implement it into your case. So even if you listen 10 minutes a day, that's 10 minutes more of knowledge that you're getting from some of the best lawyers in the country who are sharing their information. You know, I'm going and I'm sharing information. I don't have to do it, but I want to, because I think insurance companies, they have their lawyers and they have their schemes on how to screw people over, right? So here we're all coming together, this program that you put, sharing so we can, you know, be the equalizer to what they're doing. So we want to help the young lawyers so they can get better and their clients can get real justice.
We're starting off the summer right, May 8th and 9th in Hermosa Beach, California at the TLU Beach House. We're doing a 2-day witness prep and direct examination workshop. You will learn how to prepare your clients so they just don't remember their stories, but they relive them. And then we transition that to direct examination so the jury just doesn't hear the story, but they relive them. They experience them. They witness them. We'll see you there.
Yeah, and so, you know, at TLU Beach this year, we're going to have 5 lecture tracks instead of 4. So I'm kind of excited about that because the 5th lecture track is really a case analysis track. So all the people that have been busting their asses in the last year and going out and getting verdicts, but that are lesser known, right? Because there's a lot of great lawyers out there, but we just never heard of them. Or, you know, they just got their first 7-figure, 8-figure verdict. And, you know, I think those are very significant moments in people's lives. I mean, I'm sure even, you know, you remember your first 7-figure verdict. You remember your first 8-figure verdict. You probably remember your first 6-figure verdict, right?
Of course.
Because it's a process. And so I'm really excited about this, well, like, case analysis track I have, because, like, all the presenters on it are all people that have been coming to TLU and using the TLU on demand and working hard and working their cases up. And now they got some results. And, you know, mostly, you know, but just the way the world is, they wouldn't have a chance to present on them because there's only so many, so much room at every stage. And so I'm given a, like, you know, 18 people a chance to, that are going to be speaking on the trials they got. And I think it's really inspirational for people too, because they see somebody just like them. Not the Brian Panches, Nick Rallies, Gishik heads, not the people that are fucking been killing it for a long time, that this is what, okay. It's like, because people are like, oh, I don't get cases like that or whatever. That's not my life, or that's not where I live. And just having seen this vast group of people from around the country getting, you know, from Atlanta to Virginia to New Mexico, getting great results. So I'm excited about that track. But, you know, and then we have the four lecture tracks and seven other, you know, and so all those tracks are being recorded, like you said, for the TLU On Demand, because you can't be in two places at once. And
that's the beauty of the On Demand. So I go to what I want to watch, and then sometimes you have amazing stuff going on at the same time. I can't get to everything.
Right.
But the On Demand allows me the ability to do that. If you don't have On Demand, I mean, you shouldn't be practicing, really. It's just a key to getting better. If you want to get better, if you don't want to get better, TLU's not for you.
But right. If you don't want to get better,
if like, you're looking to like, get better, and not only if you step up your game, your income level is going to go up, obviously, because you're going to do better on your cases. But it's better for your clients. You're going to get them real justice.
And it's more fun to be a winner than a loser.
Absolutely.
And so, but you know, but this year we're going to have, like I said, five lecture tracks. They're all being recorded. Seven workshop tracks, which are, you know, the smaller group training, the interactive training, like your masterclass, or Ben Rabinowitz and Mike Kelly have a, you know, cross-examination of experts masterclass they do on every Wednesday of TLU. They've done it, started out in New York, you know, Vegas, even though we're not doing Vegas anymore, but Huntington Beach, and, you know, and so there's like, there's specialized learning on smaller groups. I'm doing, you know, my people, my coaches are teaching cross-examination, performance skills, you know, voir dire, and, you know, Joe Fried and Joe Camerlengo are teaching a trucking class on Saturday. That's like a master class on, you know, beating Amazon and FedEx and like these massive logistic companies that they've been, you know, really teaming up and figuring out how to, you know, hold these people accountable. You know, Amazon and like Uber, they don't want to be accountable for shit because that way it cuts into their profits. If there's to be accountability for, you know, their drivers, for God's sakes, to trying to set up, they're all independent contracts. We all know what horseshit that is. Because, you know, because like, you know, because this year Uber is really trying to screw us in California, you know, with this initiative to give 75% of every settlement or verdict to the quote unquote victim slash plaintiff and 25% to go to the doctors, the case expenses, and the lawyers. I mean, that would just put, they'd put so many people out of business. And if they're able to do it there, they'd be able to.
Right, they know what they're doing. They want to cut out all the lawyers and make it seem that, oh, this is good for people, but nobody's going to take your case.
You're not going to have a lawyer,
right?
And you're not going to get shit. No, I know, because like, so that is a big, big important thing we're doing this year to do this, because we just, you know, as just like last week, I think I moved in this house on Monday, but on Sunday, for the week before that, we were out, you know, at Nick Rowley's place in Big Sky doing a boot camp out there, like a ski boot camp, which is one of my favorite things to do, is skiing and a boot camp. But he has this big ass house out there. It was like 12, I don't know, it was huge. And it's really nice. I mean, like this area right here is like his common area is probably six times the size, maybe, of this common area, right? Where it's nice. Just like these massive ceilings and beams and this, you know, and the view is the mountains and the snow in the background. And I mean, it's an impressive place, but like gave it to us to use for the week so that we could do our boot camp and our fundraiser. Cause actually the whole ski camp started 5 years ago. Cause like he was back then, he was fighting the cause he's always got some cause he's fighting. He's a very philanthropic trial lawyer. And that was to reform the Med Mal laws back then. So we did one. We were supposed to do it at his house out there, but if something came up, we couldn't. We had to go to Tahoe. So we'd be going to Tahoe for a few years. Good thing we didn't go this year, though, because there was an avalanche. Six people got killed, like about just a few days ago. I mean, I wouldn't have been out backcountry skiing. So unlikely I would have been in avalanche territory, but still. And
so you know, raised money this time?
Yes.
And
yes,
that was for the Uber initiative? How much did you raise?
$54,000.
That was TLU?
Well, it was
in combination.
The people that I was the organizer.
Okay.
So the people came and paid tuition to that amount, and so that way they either paid it directly to, you know, to the Uber, or you know, paid the tuition to me, that I'm gonna forward to the to the Uber initiative. So I was really pretty thrilled with that, because a lot of these people from out of state too, which would they'd never be giving money to, most likely. I mean, you're not just donating to out of state lawyers. Usually, you know, you focus on your own initiatives, but you're not too often. You're like, okay, I got to go give $10,000 to these people in California, because I'm very concerned about, you know, the Uber in California. So not as likely, but it was a great time. It was a good cause, and that's important. And a lot of the, you know, we're working on having more of these boot camps this year to raise more money. Dee Robertis just called me yesterday. He says, hey, if I do a boot camp in March, can we do a boot camp for Uber if my trial gets moved? Because Dee Robertis is like the employment king. And when he does a boot camp, all of these employment people sign up. So that's going to be pretty great. And I think that's about everything we had to cover. But there's one thing that's very important here that we forgot to mention, is that this episode of about Trial Lawyers University is being brought to us and host and sponsored by, is it Preferred Capital Funding?
Yes.
Your friend Brian Gorelli.
Yes.
Because we had a little happy hour last night that he was co-sponsoring with the Chiquette Law Firm, and I invited Panish. I said, Panish, you want to come over? But he wasn't feeling so well. But he's like, that guy's the best in the business. I go, Brian?
Brian is the best.
Brian? He's like, yeah. I'm like, all right. I said, you know, and that was totally spontaneous. And, you know, Panish, if you know Panish at all, you know, one thing that Panish does is not, he does not sugarcoat shit. If he doesn't like somebody.
Straight to the point.
If he thinks somebody's full of shit, he'd be like, rah. But if he's like, when he, like, somebody, but, and he's rarely effusively complimentary of people or other businesses. But I thought that was pretty cool, because I've known Gorelli for a while. I didn't know he was just such a, you know, I know he, apparently, according to Brian, he's the best. And, you know, he's a guy you use too, so that must, yeah. And I know you look out for your clients too. And so anyways.
We gotta let him know.
We gotta let who know?
Brian.
Oh, we know Brian. He's very, you know, I think he knows though.
He knows.
He knows. Right, Brian? He knows. Mm-hmm. Anyways, so. Yep.
Yes, and I did donate $25,000 to that Uber initiative. Even though I'm a lawyer at Illinois, it was important to me when I saw that come up. So you're right, Dan. That stuff is super important, and we all need to step up and fight the fight on that.
So that's right.
Thank you, and thank you for those kind words.
All right. Well, it was Panish. I was just relating what Mr. Panish said. I'm not in the position yet that I need money from, you know, but hopefully, you know, I mean, who knows? I might have a law practice one day. You never know.
There you go.
All right. Well, we're done with here. We'll be on our way to San Diego to learn a little bit more at the AAJ. So, Sagi, if people want to get a hold of you, how do people find Sagi?
So if anybody wants to get a hold of me, look, I'm always willing to help. And I get people who've watched the on-demand or have been to some of the classes that I've taught. I give out my cell phone. I'll give it to you here. It's 305-790-5037. If anybody wants to call, again, I'm always sharing information, sharing what I got. I believe that's the way to do it. And so we can all get better.
Yes, we all got to get better. And if anybody wants to sample, wants to, a comp access code to TLU on demand, my email is dan@triallawyersuniversity.com, or my cell phone is 248-808-3130. And as far as the live conference goes, we give scholarships to law students. So if anybody you know is a law student, they want to come, all they got to do is send in an application, and there's a strong likelihood, very strong likelihood, it'll be approved, like extremely strong likelihood. And if you're a lawyer and you cannot, you know, you really truly can't afford to come to TLU, give me a call and I will help you with the tuition, because there's no excuse not to get better. So just keep that in mind.
Ready to train with the Titans and set records with your verdicts? Register for our live conferences and boot camps at triallawyersuniversity.com. Start getting your reps in before the big event by going to tluondemand.com to gain instant access to live lectures, case analysis, and skills training videos from the trial lawyer champions you love and respect, as well as pleadings, transcripts, PowerPoints, and notes for a roadmap to victory. Join the group that continues to get extraordinary results. Trial Lawyers University, produced and powered by LawPods.